Pack your bags. It's time to visit Las Vegas, America's capital for fun and entertainment. This is Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
Welcome to another hour of Vegas Never Sleeps. My name is Stephen Maggi. We have a great show for you, including Jeff Kutash, who was responsible for this fantastic show, which was part of the Riviera, which was just imploded a few months ago, called Splash. It had been there for decades, and Jeff will tell us all about that and his incredible history, both in Las Vegas and as an entertainer. Also, it's Oktoberfest, time to celebrate in Las Vegas. What better place to go than the Hofbrauhaus? We'll tell you all about that. We're going to talk to two regulars on the show, one in the world of sports, my good friend, and I really mean it. He was a friend going back to college, hadn't seen each other in decades, but we've come back together as friends again in Las Vegas. He's a great writer from the Review Journal, Steve Karp. He's going to talk about the biggest topic in sports in Las Vegas and really is heard around the world, especially with my good friends back from Oakland, California. Will the Raiders go to Las Vegas? We'll talk to Steve about that. Also, we're going to visit the Casino Hall of Fame once again with our good friend Steve Cutler and talk about the lounge acts, which were fantastic back in the day and maybe the greatest lounge act of all, Louis Prima. Finally, we're going to visit the Bellagio Museum of Fine Arts, really an incredible place. They're going to talk about the Industrial Revolution as it's seen through the eyes of the great artists. It's always a big deal in Las Vegas when an old legend goes down. You know, nothing is there forever, and the Riviera Hotel, one of the great hotels in the early days of Las Vegas, is now no more. The implosion was all over the internet, and people saw it all over the world. And unfortunately, with the loss of Riviera, you're not just losing the hotel, but a lot of the great shows were there. And one of the really incredible shows, iconic shows that I'd like to talk about today is called Splash, which was there for a number of years, and the brilliant producer of that is with us, Jeff Kutash. And Jeff, really exciting, the show Splash, because it started back in 1985, but really, it was a different type of show for Las Vegas, wasn't it?
Well, in those days, you could shoot a cannon off on Las Vegas Boulevard and not hit anything because the town was in transition and Atlantic City was just beginning and everybody found a new paradise. And in those days, the shows were mostly the French shows, Moulin Rouge, Lido, Follies Berger, that kind of thing. And then, of course, the headliners. You still had the Sinatras of the era, but you know they would play only a week here and a week there. So when we came in with Splash, there were 65 presentations made to the Riviera Hotel, and they chose mine because it was just very different than anything else. We brought water to the desert for the first time. And, you know, mermaids and Esther Williams and motorcycles and rock and roll and MTV and lasers and moving lights and pyrotechnics and things that never had existed before in Las Vegas, including the performers, street dancing, young kids. So it was very, very innovative at the time, yes.
And it's very transitional to what we have now in Las Vegas, where you have all those things. So this was really an important show that kind of, as you say, it was kind of a downtime in the history of Las Vegas and really kind of foretold some of the great things that were coming in just the next few years.
Well, we probably changed the landscape in that the next wave of entertainment that moved into Vegas became contemporary and became young, so that the old Vegas guard kind of, you know, transitioned, and we were the purveyor of that. And then Splash, it ran for 21 years, closed in 2006 when the hotel was sold, and or it still would have been there probably, but during that time period, we did something that never has happened to this day in Las Vegas, and that is that we cloned the show in two other markets simultaneously. So while Splash was playing in Las Vegas, it's also playing in Reno, Nevada, and the largest stage in America, the Reno Hilton,
right?
Bigger than Radio City Music Hall, 2,000-seater. And it was 10 times the size as the show in Vegas. So we had two shows going, And then the third company at the same time was booked. The Dentsu ad agencies came over and saw it and said, we want this show in Japan. So we had three splashes going at the same time. And again, that has never happened from a Las Vegas-born production.
Yeah, and by taking it out and reproducing it in these different spots, you were kind of a forerunner, I guess, of the Cirque du Soleil and these type of programs that we do see now. They become popular and they've got copies of it in different spots and so forth.
Yes, I would say we probably were the benchmark, Steve, in terms of Las Vegas entertainment becoming valid and original.
Yeah, it's incredible stuff, and I hope people had a chance to see that. It was just a great show. You didn't abandon the glamour and so forth, really, of old Vegas. When, you know, you talked about the Follies Project and stuff. You just brought in all this water, which was incredible. And isn't it true that it sort of inspired Steve Wynn over the Bellagio in terms of the great fountains that now everybody talks about and is a must-see in Las Vegas?
Well, it's interesting. I'll tell you that story. Steve and I are friends because he gave me my second break in Las Vegas. The first break I had was in 1974. I produced a show for Dick Clark. Dick was in the show along with Jackie Wilson and some of the great performers. And we did a show called Good Old Rock and Roll at the Hilton. We opened for a guy named Elvis Presley.
Wow. That's a big deal.
And it was amazing. He was there on our opening night and, you know, we met him and got autographs. It was crazy, wonderful time. And then in 1970, I think it was 78 or 79, a few years later, I created a dance group called The Dancing Machine. And The Dancing Machine became America's premier export. We played every country you can imagine with street dancing, which had never been seen before. And Steve Wynn booked it at the Golden Nugget. So I worked with Steve for a couple years before we then moved up to the Strip with The Dancing Machine. And then when I did Splash, moving fast forward, I hired a group out of the Valley in California, San Fernando Valley, called Wet Industries. And Wet Industries was a little garage shop fountain organization that were doing shopping malls and wherever they could get a gig, building these custom fountains. And I hired them to build all brand new original fountains for Splash. And again, fast forward 5-6 years later, Steve Wynn builds the Bellagio, and he goes to my guys because I had given him the information, and he builds the Bellagio fountains. Well, today, Wet Industries is the largest fountain company in the world. They have two city blocks in Burbank, 10 buildings. They did the Dubai fountains and the Amsterdam fountains and so on and so forth. So this little garage shop became the number one fountain company in the world.
It's an amazing story. You really had an amazing career. You know, people, you know, if they were going to listen to this show and they think, oh, he did this great show in Las Vegas, there's a lot more than that. That's just what we're talking about here today. But we also, I want to talk to you about it. I know you've been in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You have choreographed for some of the really greats. I mean, you're talking about James Brown, Otis Redding. You mentioned Jackie Wilson. These people are huge. How does one get into that business? I mean, your career fascinates me. How did you ever get into that? And, you know, again, is it just being creative or what?
I graduated high school early, and I moved on to Ohio State University. I'm from Cleveland, by the way, born there. And I go to see a James Brown concert in Columbus, and my mouth dropped when I saw this guy. I always loved rock and roll, but I'd never seen anything like it before. So I go back to Cleveland for summer vacation, and I'm watching a television show called The Big Five Show. And I watch these kids dancing, and they're really lame. I mean, it was like silly dancing and not the real street dancing that we did in college and that, you know, came from that central Midwest area. Right. You know, there were 100 dances in those days, the Jerk, the Watusi, the Frug, the Swim, the Monkey, the this, the that. I mean, 100 dances. So I called the producer of the TV show, and I said, you know, what you guys are doing is not really what's happening. He said, well, who are you? And I said, I'm just a fan. He said, well, why don't you come down here and show me what you're talking about? So I drive downtown to WWS, the Scripps Howard station, and I literally jump on the guy's desk and start doing the mashed potatoes and all the stuff that I saw James Brown doing. And he said, you're exactly what I've been looking for. Do you want to be our choreographer? And I said, sure. I didn't even know what the word meant.
Yeah.
and then I figured it, he explained it to me. So I put together a dance group. And again, fast forward, the show winds up going national. It's called The Upbeat Show. And it ran for 4.5 years all over the country. And we played everybody from the Beatles to the Stones to Otis and James Brown. And when James Brown came in to do the show with his 26-piece orchestra, he's watching me dance, and he comes over to me and says, "How does a boy like you know how a white boy like you know how to dance like that?" And I said, "Well, I learned it from you." And he asked me if I would be his choreographer, and I wound up having a 20-year relationship with James. And then that went on to become, we became the opening act for Sinatra, Dean, and Sammy. And then I wound up choreographing John Travolta's moves for Saturday Night Fever.
Incredible.
And then Michael Jackson. I did the Midnight Special with Mad Jack on NBC for a number of years. And Michael came to me and said, "I want to learn how to do all this popping and locking and the stuff that you're doing." And I taught him how to do the moonwalk. It was actually called the Backslide. And that went on to then become Cher. I even taught Muhammad Ali how to dance after he lost the fight to Leon Spinks. He took off for a while, and his people contacted me and he wanted to learn how to dance. So I've had this fun period of choreography that ran through the 70s and the disco era. And so I've had this, part of it was luck. Part of it was being at the right place at the right time. And the other part was just, I was inventing it. I was kind of like the architect of street dancing. And then the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they finally admitted Upbeat into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. And I had to go back and dance in front of Cleveland Live.
In a few moments, more with choreographer and Las Vegas legend Jeff Kutash. This is Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
World-class hotels, dining, gaming, special events, and more. This is Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
I'm here with Logan Reed, my own personal business coach. You know, a lot of people may think this is all a bunch of psychobabble and that kind of thing, but in reality, this is stuff that on the surface may seem like we're going to explore our background, but actually we're just getting really in touch with ourselves to see how we can be more successful. Is that what you try to do with people?
It is. So I'm not so interested in what's happened in the past. What I'm looking for is where people are now, where they want to be, and coaching always takes place in the gap. So what are the things, where are the places where they're getting stopped that's in that gap? And then when we move through those, they end up having what they want, whatever their goal is for themselves.
Okay, we're all excited about it now. So how do we get involved? How do we get more information about you and what you're doing?
Sure. You can give me a call at 360-529-1848 or email me at logan@loganreedcoaching.com. And you could also check out my website if you want to learn more about me at loganreedcoaching.com.
Waste management has earth-friendly plans that fit the biggest corporations, and recycling programs to help smaller companies get started. We're there for you every night and on the job with you every day. When you put waste management to work, you get an environmental partner and big ideas for every size business. From everyday collection to environmental protection, think green. Think waste management. To learn more, visit WM.com.
You are listening to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member and Las Vegas show producer Jeff Kutash. But, you talk about Cleveland, you kind of strike me as somebody as a great descendant of Alan Freed, in the sense that you were doing stuff that wasn't being done. And, the idea that you could watch James Brown, you're like Mick Jagger in the sense he did the same thing where he said that they played behind after James Brown was on in a concert, and that's where Mick got all his moves. Just saying, he goes, "My gosh, I have to do that."
Well, the evolution of all of that, of course, started back in the 50s when rock and roll came in and Elvis and all of that. And then in the 60s, there really was an explosion because it then transcended to fashion and vernacular, to say nothing of the music taste that changed and the British invasion and And as that evolution took place, of course, the audiences became the stars, because when disco came in the early 70s, the audience, there were no major stars. They were all pre-recorded attractions, other than maybe Donna Summer and a handful of others. Disco yeah. was an era where it was all recordings.
Wow. Well, what do you think of today's world and of hip-hop and so forth? Are you liking what you're seeing? I mean, you look at Hamilton on Broadway and so forth, or do you kind of look at it now and go, wow, you know, the golden days are over?
The music dictates everything, Steve. What it is that, you know, there's drums, there's guitar, there's horns, there's even strings, there's certainly bass lines, and dancing follows that formula. So whatever the music is telling you to do dictates how the dancing evolves. That's really where it comes from, and that's what a choreographer does. You dissect a piece of music, and that's how you put the moves into the production. So hip-hop today is basically an outgrowth of, you know, breakdancing, and before that it was street dancing and popping and locking, and before that it was the 100 dances I told you about.
Yeah.
So there's this wonderful flow that has covered the last 50 years, 60 years actually.
It sounds like it's all about the beat. You know, if you can get a beat, you can do something with it.
Well, it's the beat, but then, you know, because the beats become very similar. I mean, you can imagine over 60 years, the beats can only, you know,
yeah,
change
only so,
so
much.
Much.
Yeah.
But it's the other instrumentations, and of course it's the orchestrations that dictate. I mean, Hamilton is a great example. I mean, a lot of the moves in Hamilton, I can show you a video from 50 years ago, and it's the same moves recycled.
Wow, it's just incredible stuff. And I love, by the way, the story of Taxi. That was one of the great shows. If people haven't seen it, you ought to go onto YouTube and take a look at it. And I do remember that entire thing. Well, like I said, fantastic career. It's not over yet, though. What are you up to now?
Well, because of my roots and where my heart is, I believe that there's a whole generation of young people that have never seen what we created back in the day and what we basically invented. So I'm working on a project now called Soul Brothers, which is the history and the evolution of soul music and all that went with it. So anyway, I'm taking that wonderful era and recycling it, reintroducing it, I should say, to Las Vegas audiences and legitimate audiences on the West End of London and hopefully on Broadway. And I'm going back to Splash. I did a documentary about, oh my goodness, it's been 30 years now. When we opened Splash, I had a camera crew work with us for 6 months, and they followed us from opening, signing the contract, which is, by the way, a four-week contract with options and that ran 21 years. But the building of the show, the rehearsals, the show itself, and it's a classic piece because, nobody did that in those days where you would have a camera crew for 6 months watching the show being built. And I'm going to introduce that show. It's called Making a Splash. And I'm going to, actually, the stuff that we talked about today will be available for the public to see as a documentary. We'll enter some film festivals and see what happens.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest in this. All of this, Jeff, is exciting. We want to stay in touch with you because we want to hear when those things get a little closer, when they're ready to release. All great stuff. But in the meantime, they can check you out on YouTube or just put your name in. Well, Jeff, if we want to follow you on the internet and such, what can we do? Where do we go?
You know, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, if you Google my name, and it's spelled K-U-T-A-S-H, Kutash, it's fortunately with the internet now, you know, you don't have to go and compile things. It's all there. And there's just a ton of stuff globally of everything we did from Dancing Machine to Splash to me personally and all the stars I worked with and so on.
Well, Jeff, real pleasure. We'll love to have you on again. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. It's been my pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to go to visit Bavaria, Germany, one of those great places you can visit in Las Vegas. Yeah, the Hofbräu House. You don't want to miss it. We're going to celebrate Oktoberfest in Las Vegas. You're listening to Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
Visit us at VegasNeverSleeps.com. This is Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
I'm here with Logan Reed, my own personal business coach, and part of this is just getting rid of some of the fears that really stop us from accomplishing the things we want to in our lives.
Yes, so we all have our fears and the places where we get stopped in our life. So I always say that coaching is about moving forward at the places where we would normally get stopped. We all get scared, we all get stopped, and when we can keep moving forward, that's when we create things that we would have never thought possible.
So how do we get involved?
Email me at Logan@LoganReedCoaching.com. And you could also check out my website if you want to learn more about me at LoganReedCoaching.com.
You know, when you come to Vegas, you can get a cultural experience you won't believe. You can go to Paris, you can go to Venice and stuff. Well, you can also head off to the Bavaria, and we have a great place you gotta go to. It's called Hofbräuhaus in Las Vegas. You see it, it's right near the airport, right across from the Hard Rock Hotel. And with me is the vice president, one of the owners, Tony Sinsger. Tony, great place. You've been around for a while. Do people, are they surprised that there's such an authentic restaurant right here, easily accessible?
Yeah, we opened in January 2004. It was a surprise in the beginning, but right now we are established and people know where they have to go for authentic Bavarian food and for the excellent beer, what we import from Munich, Germany.
Yeah, it's really outstanding stuff. We're going to talk about the Oktoberfest, which you don't want to miss. But I do have a question. I mean, I see a huge parking lot. This is a big restaurant. The response was really strong. Talk about some of the specialties that you offer here that people just can't wait to have.
Right now we celebrate Oktoberfest, and to celebrate a real Oktoberfest, the important thing is you need the original beer, and the Hofbräuhaus Las Vegas is the only place in Las Vegas where you get the real Oktoberfest beer, was the people drink right now in Munich, Germany at the Oktoberfest. But this is not only the beer, also the food is very important, and we have German chefs in the kitchen, and our menu is really Bavarian, authentic Bavarian food. And we also have every day Bavarian entertainment. We bring over the bands from Germany or from Austria. We also do some games. We make steinholding contests on the weekend, and we make drinking contests. The band is playing the Alphorn, and right now during Oktoberfest, every Friday, every Saturday, we have celebrity keg tappings. We tap the first keg of Oktoberfest beer with Siegfried and Roy. And today is the celebrity chef Carla Pellegrino coming, and tomorrow Frank Mir, the UFC fighter, and so on. Oktoberfest goes until end of October, and we have Rich Little, we have Clint Holmes, we have we have other performers at the strip like Fantasy Girls and Australian Bee Gees, Chippendales, and so on, yeah.
Well, you got something for everybody, and it's great. They're right across from the Hard Rock, like I said, so you can enjoy the classic rock and roll over there, then come over here and step into a different world. An outstanding menu, I got to tell you. It got everything you could possibly imagine here. Some great stuff. I'm going to have the Wiener Schnitzel today. How's that look?
Wiener Schnitzel is our most selling item, yeah. It's very famous, and people love it. Yeah. This is really like in Munich. This is the same quality, the same taste. Do you like it?
Well, this is great. And for Oktoberfest, this is really fantastic. How can they find out more? Where do they go? Is there a place they can go on the web to find out more? And do you need reservations for this?
It makes sense to make reservations, especially on the weekend, Friday, Saturday. But if you check our website, everything is on it, all the information you get there. We also on every social media channels where you can get information, actual what's going on right now, and you will find what we're doing right now.
Well, Tony, thank you so much. We're all going to come out and visit Hofbräuhaus in Las Vegas. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, will next year's Oktoberfest feature pro football in Vegas? Let's ask our Vegas sports expert, Steve Karp, sports writer from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Kind of update us on where we're at and kind of your prediction of what we can look for to happen.
Well, last week the Stadium Commission approved moving forward with the project. It's $1.9 billion, $750 million of which will have to be raised through public funding via a increase in the hotel tax, which will be roughly 88 cents a day per person. So if you stay in a hotel here, you'll see an extra 88 cents a day on your bill. You probably won't even notice it. The Raiders are kicking in $550 million. Sheldon Adelson, who owns the Venetian, who also owns our paper, the Review-Journal, is going to kick in $650 million. So they're still trying to find the right location. And I think the I-15 Russell Road location they're talking about is the best one, because it's by two different freeways, 15 and the 215 Beltway, and that would give people access from across the valley to get there and stuff. It would take 3 years to build, and there's two big fights left before this thing becomes reality. The first is the state legislature will have to sign off on this, which means the Governor Brian Sandoval is going to have to call a special session of the legislature, which he is expected to do in the next couple of weeks. Remember, there's an election in November. There's a lot of people who are still trying to maintain their spots in the legislature. So they got to do this quickly. And it's also going to cut into their time while they're campaigning. So it's a very tricky process. Assuming they approve it, the Raiders will petition the NFL owners in January at their meeting to move to Vegas. And that's where the other big hurdle is, because Roger Goodell, the commissioner, apparently is still resisting putting a team here for whatever reason. I don't know if it's a gambling issue or he just doesn't like Vegas or what have you. So it's going to be Goodell and whatever owners he can get on his side against Jerry Jones and Bob Kraft and Stan Kroenke, who were squarely in Mark Davis's corner and wield a lot of influence throughout the league. So it's going to be a very interesting battle to see who wins in January, assuming the legislature does approve it, which I think they will, by the way, because you'll have some people, you know, saying I'm not for public money and all that, and stuff, because they got to speak to their constituents, especially if you're up north and there's really no residual benefit, although there's talk they might hold training camp up in Reno with Sparks or something to placate the Northern Nevada contingency. But that being said, it's looking more like they are going to eventually come here than back in January when the idea first was being floated out there. And things have happened so quickly here over the last 9 months, and it's really amazing that they've been able to get as much done as they have. And to me, I think if I were a betting man, I'd have to say I think it's going to happen.
I'm thinking the odds are about 50-50. You can read Steve Karp every day in the Las Vegas Review-Journal at reviewjournal.com. Well, if you want culture, Las Vegas has it. We visited the Bellagio Gallery of Fine Arts to see what's going on there. Speaking to Teresa Tiberti, what's your actual title here? This is this incredible museum. I'm just blown away by some of the art that's around me.
I'm the executive director.
Okay, and as the executive director, I read a little about your history. You actually were from Nevada, right? Left to go see the world and found out that some of the great art is here, and this just became a great home for you. Kind of tell us your story, if you would.
Certainly, yes. I was born and raised here. My father was as well, so I moved far away and was trying to pursue a career elsewhere and got pulled back here to run this fabulous institution, gallery. And it was something really unique, because when I was growing up here in Las Vegas, we didn't have any artwork like this. We had a very, very small museum that was in Lorenzi Park, and I didn't even really realize that until I, you know, left and came back. There's a Klaus Oldenburg sculpture at UNLV that I used to go see all the time, but never knew the magnitude or what it was until, again, leaving and living in New York City and studying art and then coming back to Las Vegas. So it's a great opportunity.
Yeah, and it's got to be exciting. People don't realize this is a world-class museum that they can come by and visit. Just talk about some of the items you have here that people can see on a regular basis.
Absolutely. So the collection is from the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. So it's incredible to see, you know, their collection out on the West Coast if you don't, you know, visit the East Coast, and this is your one trip away. So there's two pieces by Degas. There's a Van Gogh. There's Monet, Renoir. There's some fabulous works on paper, Toulouse-Lautrec, Millet paintings, some Beckmann lithographs as well. So many incredible things, a mix of paintings, lithographs, photographs, a variety.
More with Teresa Tiberti, Executive Director of the Bellagio Gallery of Fine Arts. You're listening to Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
Is there something you've always wanted to know about Las Vegas? Drop us a line at info@vegasneversleeps.com. This is Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.
This year, more than 172,000 people will be told they have lung cancer.
Lung cancer.
60% will wonder why.
Why?
As they never smoked or quit smoking years ago. Lung cancer will kill 163,000 people this year. More people than breast, prostate, colon, liver, and kidney cancers combined, making it by far America's number one cancer killer.
Cancer killer.
But there is hope. New treatments are available and more are on the way. The Lung Cancer Alliance is working to focus attention and research on lung cancer to develop early detection tools and more treatment options. Lung Cancer Alliance is leading the charge as the only organization solely dedicated to providing support, resources, and a voice for people touched by lung cancer and those at risk for the disease. Join us in the fight against lung cancer. The time has come. No more excuses. No more lung cancer. To learn more, visit lungcanceralliance.org or call 1-800-298-2436.
You'd never suspect that you could find natural beauty as part of a working landfill. You can. Today, waste management landfills provide more than 17,000 acres of protected land for wildlife habitats. Working closely with communities and the Wildlife Habitat Council, we can ensure there will be protected space for native animal and plant life to thrive. From everyday collection to environmental protection, think green. Think waste management.
Listening to Teresa Tiberti, the executive director of the Bellagio Gallery of Fine Arts at the Bellagio Hotel. And I understand the docents here can explain a lot of these things where, you know, you can come and visit this and in addition to just being blown away by what you see, you can actually get some more of the history of this and so forth and really understand, you know, just how important this is to world history.
Absolutely. The docents are a great tool that we have here at the gallery. They provide their own tour, so it really gives their perspective on what they get out of it, or maybe what they're learning in art history in school. So it kind of gives their personality within the tour, which is a fabulous way because you get seven different insights into the exhibition. So depending upon which day you go to and which docent you get, I think they're all fabulous, though, so I couldn't choose a favorite.
You know, an executive director of something like this, you know, how much can your personality come into this? I would imagine that this is a place, you know, based on your training and your own likes and dislikes, that you can really kind of bring some of that own personality into it. Is it that true?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I think it's fun when you get to curate shows because, again, you're choosing some of the works. And even if it's an exhibition like this where there was a traveling exhibition, we're a smaller gallery, so we get to choose a selection of what they have. So again, then it gets to kind of come to me and my personality, and then how we set up the show, any colors we use, the advertisements, those types of things I all have input in, which is, you know, a fun thing to do.
Oh, it's great, and of course the critics love it as well. I want to ask you about this particular display because I'm really interested in it. I'm a history buff, and this is about the Industrial Revolution and the idea of moving from rural to urban. Talk a little about what you have and how that's kind of learned through these great drawings and paintings and such.
Sure. Like the Van Gogh piece, for instance, is a weaver, and so he was very you know, kind of becoming distraught because his family had a history of, you know, being workers. And so it was that age where now the weaving and the loom was going to be outdated and wasn't going to be needed because machines were going to take place. So he painted, it's not a typical Van Gogh painting, but he was doing this weaving scene. There's also, you know, the city was really picking up and having this lifetime come to it. So there's a Folies-Bergère scene by Toulouse-Lautrec, some cafe nighttime scenes, you know, so you really feel the energy of Paris. And then there's some beautiful country scenes as well that are showing, you know, people enjoying the countryside, like in the Degas painting, where they're, you know, riding on the carriage with the horses, and a Renoir painting of some a girl by the seaside and some children. So again, just some beautiful kind of contrast to what the city was and the country after the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, and it does sort of share that kind of the cultural history of what was going on, where people can really see it through the eyes of the artist, which is really a different experience than just reading stories and people giving their opinions. You're actually seeing how these people saw what was going on.
Yes, and you know, I say this a lot, and I know the curator actually did as well, but time and history is so important. Every time you look at artwork, you must put it in the context. And we've said that with Picasso in the Picasso exhibition. And again, I think for this exhibition, because you're talking about, you know, there was new materials that were coming about that these artists were then being able to use. So maybe not just your traditional oil paints, but what that time frame really did, not only, you know, psychologically or in terms of land and movement and how these people and transportation, but also the physical materials that they're using within the artworks.
Now, that's incredible stuff. Well, let's tell people how they can come find out about it, what you're talking about. It always changes, so it's something you want to keep your eye on every time you visit. How do they do? Where do they go on the web, for example?
If you go to bellagio.com/BGFA, there's tickets available. There's always information. And then, you know, if you come to the to Bellagio, you can buy tickets at the ticket counter, concierge, or the box office. We're open daily, 10 to 8 p.m. We do last admission at 7:30. We have our daily docent tour every day at 2 p.m. That's complimentary with your admission. We offer various admission prices. We also have an audio guide with our admission, which is another great tool and way to kind of learn different things versus what the docent gives you.
Well, this is just a beautiful place. Everybody needs to see it. Thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, it's time to chat with Steve Cutler, the man behind the incredible Casino Legends Hall of Fame. Now, you talk about famous entertainers going to see those foreplay, and we could all understand that. But there were acts, they used to say the lounge acts, that everybody would go and see. It was late at night, and one of my very favorites, and one of the most famous here, and of course, he's there with his wife, Louis Prima, and of course, his wife, Keely Smith, and I guess Sam Batero was the backup band. Everybody used to come to see them.
Oh, my gosh. They were unbelievable. And you know, it's really funny because a few years ago, there was a song on the radio that everybody was listening to, and all the young kids just loved it. And they really didn't even know who the singer was. And it was a re-release of something that Louis Prima did, Jump, Jive, and Wail. People never realized that that was Louis Prima, and this was done back in the 50s. And thank God we have his daughter, Lena, who actually is carrying on the tradition and still to this day performs all over the country singing all of her father's greatest hits.
Oh, that's fantastic. And yeah, the Brian Setzer Orchestra, that's who actually does the theme song there, has kind of picked up on that music. And thank God they did the movie Jungle Book, because for some people that didn't get out here, that was the first time they found out who Louis Prima was.
Oh, that's true. And you know, it wasn't just Louis Prima back then. It was another one of the great entertainers that played the lounges back in those days was Freddie Bell. Actually, it was Freddie Bell and the Bell Boys. And one of the songs that he did, he recorded in 1953, was Hound Dog, which he later gave to Elvis Presley. And obviously, we all know Elvis Presley for that song, and he made the big hit out of it. But we've had so many great, great lounge entertainers over the years. Shecky Green, Rich Little. I mean, I can just go right on down the list. They've all started out in the lounges. And incidentally, today, in today's Las Vegas, lounge entertainment is usually looked at as a lower form of entertainment. versus the main showroom. Back in the 50s and 60s, lounge entertainment was not necessarily lesser entertainment. It was simply a smaller, more intimate venue. And the entertainment that came out of the lounges was generally more entertaining than what came out of the big showrooms because it was personal. And you would see people in the audience like Frank Sinatra at many of these shows.
Well, I know one of the people who got not discovered there, but that's where he really got popular, was Don Rickles. And they said everybody in town would go to see Rickles over there, and you wanted him to insult you.
That's the truth. Boy, he owned the Sahara for years. And he was the act, and he's still performing to this day. Unbelievable. I'm not sure how old he is, but he's well into his 80s. Just like Tony Bennett, I believe just turned 90. Unbelievable entertainers. Marty Allen, who I just saw a couple weeks ago, he still performs. He's 93 now. These legends, you know, God bless them. They're still with us. They're still performing, and nobody does it better.
You can check out the Casino Legends Hall of Fame online. Just go to CasinoLegendsHallOfFame.com. Well, thanks for joining me today. I'm Stephen Maggi, and remember, Vegas never sleeps.
We'll see you next week for more excitement and energy from the desert. This is Vegas Never Sleeps with Stephen Maggi.